Land, sea, and air are three of the classical elements that humankind has been harnessing for millennia. And we've got so good at it, in fact, that we've turned it into a sport. So, in this episode, we're going to explore some of the more unconventional pastimes. And if you're wondering why I look so tired today, because we've got up at the crack of dawn to take to the skies in a hot air balloon. Dimitri, why is the best time to fly in a hot air balloon either dawn or dusk, apart from to take good Instagram pictures?
The sun heats the Earth unevenly and across different surfaces, creating vertical thermal air currents, simply known as thermals, due to the varying heat levels. These currents can be very strong, up to tens of meters per second, and are invisible. The power of a burner cannot overcome their strength. Therefore, light aviation can fly when the atmosphere is calm. In classical meteorology, winds pick up during the day and calm by sunset. This is exactly why we long for calm, peaceful weather.
So I've always wondered since childhood why the fabric of the hot air balloon doesn't catch fire from the burner. Is it made from some sort of fire-resistant material?
It can certainly catch fire and burn quickly. But that's what the pilot is there for, to prevent the flame from reaching the envelope. Burn-throughs do happen, more during takeoff or landing, when there's some side wind. So it burns, and gets repaired.
Dimitri, are we completely at the mercy of the winds here, or is there a way of controlling the balloon by varying its height and trying to catch different winds?
In general, the wind is always slightly different at the top and bottom. Traditionally, it seems the northern hemisphere has stronger winds and more to the right as altitude increases. So within this range, by ascending and descending, you can somehow correct your course. But otherwise, we fly where the elements take us.
I know, of course, there are balloon races. What's the maximum speed a balloon could reach like this one?
The maximum speed is exactly the speed of the wind. In principle, it's not that crucial at higher altitudes. You can fly at high speed. The balloon moves within an air current. Our speed, relative to the surrounding atmosphere, is zero. Therefore, especially if we are up high, we don't notice it. We drift with the flow, guided only by instruments or the ground. The critical speed, of course, is near the ground, during landing and takeoff.
What do you say is the most important thing to know as a balloon pilot? Is it the weather, navigation, physics?
It's all interconnected. In this regard, ballooning itself, especially in sport, is multifaceted. It requires physical strength, an unusual daily routine, and of course, meteorology. That's everything for us. Clouds and wind speed. We learn to predict weather, foresee different scenarios. Understanding air currents is very important, of course.
What was the most hair-raising flight or landing you've ever had?
Perhaps it's more interesting to talk about unusual flights rather than scary ones. These are long flights. We flew with the guys from Ufar over the Ural Mountains several times and made long-distance flights. The guys from Nizhny Novgorod and Kazan organized races to see how far their balloons can fly during daylight hours.
Wow. And how long was your flight and how many kilometers did you go?
The flight duration was about 7 hours, and we covered approximately 300 and something kilometers.
Amazing. So the hot air balloon is considered to be one of the safest forms of air travel. Why is that, especially given the way that they land?
Our envelope is essentially a large parachute. When we're training, there's an exercise called cold descent. From an altitude of 3 kilometers, we completely stop heating the air. The balloon starts descending. The vertical speed stabilizes at 4.5 to 5 meters per second. 4.5 meters per second is the average landing speed of a military paratrooper. So if you just bend your knees, you won't break anything. It'll be a hard landing, but not dangerous. This means our passive safety is top-notch.
I've heard a Russian phrase that there's nothing scarier than a fearless pilot. Are you scared of anything, Dmitry?
I agree. Just like the highest mortality rate among pilots and drivers is during their second year of being professional, when they think they're invincible. This is a major safety issue, and it often manifests on the ground when making the decision to fly or not. When your passengers have arrived, eager to fly, and the weather seems fine, and you're about to make some money. At that moment, realizing that the weather isn't great and deciding to cancel a flight is probably key in terms of overall aviation safety.
Dmitry, thank you very much.
We're at Maxima Park, just outside of Moscow. It's one of the world's most advanced training centers for horse riders and their equine counterparts. And I know just the person to tell us more.
Sergei. This place is a bit like a five-star hotel. You have vibration platforms, automatic walkers, even solariums. I wouldn't mind staying here myself. How does this affect the performance of the horses here?
You're absolutely right. Not five, but 7 stars. The highest level of amenities. This is the best equestrian sports center in Europe. Not just because it's the largest. It's the most technologically advanced and the most comfortable, not just for the horses, but for the athletes too. Just consider this, 120 competitions per year. No one in the world has ever had such an intensive approach to sports. To briefly explain how we treat our horses, if you walked in, you'll have seen our veterinary center. It's currently the most state-of-the-art center in the world. We have extraordinary equipment, but most importantly, we have extraordinary people who know how to operate it.
And the horse breeding, do they breed different types of horses for all the different disciplines?
A racehorse is completely different from a sports horse. A horse used for pulling carriages in a harness is completely different as well.
Uh-huh. And how are they different?
The bloodline, which goes back many generations, 7 generations deep. Experts know each generation as well as the founders of these lines. This horse, for example, truly passes on its traits to its offspring and all descendants, born and specially trained for dressage. Another horse is clearly oriented for jumping. A third horse is bred for speed. A fourth is specifically bred for trotting. Some are ready for harness work. There are ponies, and there are large horses for police service. This particular horse is exclusively for dressage. It has unique movements, height, strength, and mass, and most importantly, tremendous energy and a desire to move in this direction. It's difficult to train it for anything else. It can be done, but it's difficult, and there's no point in teaching it to jump because it was born to be a dressage star.
Sergei, can you spot a champion horse from birth?
Of course. We'll now take a look at the other horses, and you'll understand the difference. Hey, come on, open up.
What a beauty. I love the haircut as well. So this horse, tell me about this horse, Sergei.
This is a slightly different story. This is actually an example of a great friendship in the deepest sense of the word. His father is a Russian saddle horse. The creation of the Russian saddle horse is a truly unique and legendary story. It was the best horse in the world at one time. At all horse shows in the 19th century, the Russian saddle horses always won. Count Orlov created it. He brought a horse named Smetanka from Persia, leading it all the way here by hand. He paid 70,000 rubles for it. That was an enormous sum of money at the time. It's even hard to comprehend today's value. And that horse settled in Russia and produced a unique lineage. The main traits are are, they should always be black, with burning eyes and an energetic character. His father, this Russian saddle horse, was born at Starozhilovsky stud farm. The breed was restored. Theoretically, it should have been impossible, but practically, it happened. So his father was purchased in Russia, and I trained him myself to compete in the World Championship in Normandy. I was very sad to lose that bloodline, but I had a good German mare, a really beautiful, striking one. Unfortunately, she had health issues and couldn't participate in big sports events. Then came their son, born out of a friendship between nations. His mother is German with French origins. His father is a Russian saddle horse. And that combination produced a unique horse. I have high hopes for him now. He has good movement, a good temperament. He inherited a lot from his father, and some traits from his mother too. But he's taken so much from his father, especially his intelligence. In our sport, that's extremely important.
So you can tell from its mother and its father, its heritage, that there are good chances this horse is going to be a solid one.
I am confident. It's a tradition of two lines, two directions, two schools. The German and Russian equestrian schools have merged into one beautiful stallion. Okay, let's see another horse. We have 600 horses here, but only six of them are mine.
Sergey, you touched on the price of a horse before, and I'm sure you're aware that the legendary Sharif Dancer was sold as a foal for around $40 million in the 80s. Why do people spend such huge amounts of money on horses?
That's a good question. In Germany, they'd give you a short but insightful answer. As professionals say, if you don't have money, play football. If you have money, buy a horse. That's all you need to know. In classic horse racing, since you mentioned it, everything is extremely expensive, mainly because the prize money is enormous. This also affects the balance of price, because along with glory and pleasure, you hope to recoup your expenses and get some return. In our sport, in equestrian sports, the prize money is slightly lower, but that's not a given. It's also increasing. The biggest prize so far has been 14 million euros. But money nowadays isn't the issue. It's about the relationship with the horse. The focus is not on the athlete, the rider, or the owner. The important thing is the horse. Everything revolves around them. The beautiful stables, the investments, MRI and other technology, and so on. It's all to ensure that they're comfortable here, that they feel like partners beside us. We don't exploit them. We simply give them the opportunity to fulfill their potential. That brings us back to our earlier conversation. Everything in a horse has been passed down through generations. Our job is completely to give them the chance to express themselves. We believe it wasn't in vain that man cultivated the horse. Horses have been by our side for millennia, for centuries. They have been part of education. Today, we don't teach them, they teach us. About humanity, attentiveness, and respect. We always say that we're athletes, that we train and teach. But if we talk about morality, it's from the horses that we learn.
And I can see the relationship you have here with your horses, Sergey, and I can see that they feel very comfortable around you as well. Now, obviously, yeah. So there's a competition going on today, Sergey. Can we go and check it out? Sergey, how important is the bond between the horse and the rider during the show jumping event? You can imagine there's a lot of trust on both sides.
The International Federation has a slogan, one team, two hearts. That's our motto. It's extremely important here. We must understand that there is no rider without a horse, or a horse without a rider. It's always a pair, and a pair is always a team. It means combined responsibility, shared joys and sorrows, always together. We need to understand that. It's a team. There's also the coach and many others, but the rider and horse are one.
And how does a rider build such a strong relationship with a horse?
That's a good question, because today you can buy a horse that's ready to race, but it's not always justified. Not because of the high price, but because the rider needs to grow together with the horse. Usually, it goes like this. A good horse for a good rider. An experienced horse is chosen for a young rider. An experienced horse is called a schoolmaster, passing on its knowledge and skills to the rider. But when the rider is ready, when they're mature and have skills, knowledge and mastery of their tools, they buy a young horse and train it. Then they become one organism. The rider knows exactly exactly what the horse is thinking, feeling, and how it experiences the competitions. And the horse understands exactly what the rider wants. Their minds become one. They fuse together, as I said before. They don't just act alike. They think alike. It's crucial to achieve better results.
Is it too much to say that horses might even have a competitive streak themselves? Do they have a sense of when they've performed well or poorly in a competition, or is that too far?
Sometimes it happens. We often trust our horses. A horse can solve many tasks, and when the rider faces an impossible task, the best thing to do is close your eyes and trust the horse. Not literally. I, of course, mean you rely on the horse. A horse is an athlete, no matter what people say. It's just as driven for sports. Horses also want to be active. They have passion in them. If a horse doesn't have that enthusiasm, it should be retired or sent to the field. But when a horse is truly a fighter with a big heart, regardless of age or physical condition, it fights for the result. Such a horse is invaluable and is always chosen. This is an advantage. Among all other advantages, the main one is the fervor, being a fighter.
You can take that in all walks of life as well, Sergei, not just show jumping and horse riding.
Yeah.
So breeders can obviously use genetics to produce some pretty spectacular animals, horses here. But how much can temperament be bred, or how much does it depend on how a horse is raised, brought up?
We've talked about the importance of breeding and genetics, but education and training are no less important. The horse inherits everything from its parents, ancestors, and nature itself, including its spirituality and other things. Everything's so intertwined. But you need to bring it all together and let the horse unlock its potential. The rider is of great help here as the person putting in substantial and meticulous effort long term. We have a plan, a strategy, or a tactic for that growth. You can only do this precious work if you've mastered all the tools. Truly love your horse and realize how important it is to you. That's why a horse is so costly. All this doesn't just happen overnight. No matter how well-bred and naturally gifted a horse is, or what its parents have passed on at birth, that's just the starting point, the foundation. All of that needs to be shown to the public, and for that, years of hard work and knowledge are required.
Well, Sergei, I know you're very busy today. Thank you so much for your time. It's been very interesting. Thank you.
What better way to wrap up the program than to set sail off into the sunset with the wind in our hair and spray in our faces? We've come to the Moscow Regatta, where people of all skill levels can come and test their abilities.
Zhenya, what beautiful yachts you have here. Is there any room for passengers, or does everyone have to pitch in? Can I give you a hand today?
Yes, we can go sailing together. Every crew member is important, and there will be work for everyone. Let's go.
Excellent, let's do it. So tying a wide variety of knots is obviously crucial to sailing. Which is the knot that you use mainly, and can you teach me how to do it, please?
A square knot is used to tie two ends of rope together. It's quite simple. We lay one rope end over the other, tuck it under, and pull it through the loop, then reverse the direction, and we have a square knot. Give it a try.
So I have sort of left over right,
yes,
like that, and then right over left, like that.
Yes.
Awesome.
Good.
Am I ready to go sailing now?
Yeah.
Ready?
Ready? Yeah? Yeah?
Go, go!
Yeah, go. So, Zhenya, how do you learn how to read the wind, the waves, the weather? Does it take a long time?
Yes, it's a great sensation, something that we feel with our skin. Uh-huh. There are also indicators on the sail that help read the wind. That thread over there is called the telltale.
Mm-hmm.
If I put the yacht's bow into the wind, see, it stops.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Slowing down.
To start moving again, we turn a little bit. The sail catches wind and we're moving.
It's like we're surfing against the wind.
And we act as counterweights as well. Mm-hmm. The wind loads up the sails while we sit here like this, counterbalancing the boat to help her go faster.
And how many hours does it take to be able to sail a vessel like this?
In low winds, we can learn to sail a boat in 10 to 12 hours.
Really?
However, to get ready to sail out at sea, in oceans, and in storms, you need to go through some training and overcome challenges. Once you've been in a storm, or had an anchor drop off, or a sail torn, or your boat dragged away by the wind,
you know how to behave in each situation.
That's when you are ready for proper ocean sailing. First of all, you need to listen to your captain. He's always the highest in command on a vessel, and if the captain is calm and composed, you'll be rescued in any scenario. Our rescue services do an amazing job.
Well, I hope they don't need them today. And how many people are normally in a team or a crew on a yacht like this?
3, 4, or 5 people is enough, or even just 2 people, like you and I are sailing right now.
And how are the roles defined? Who's the main person on the ship?
The captain is always in charge. He decides where the yacht goes, how fast or slow. He decides where to go and where to berth. Aside from that, you can take any role. You can steer or handle the sails. It doesn't matter.
You can probably read what each person's thinking without even having to say it when you become such a close team.
Yes, a team made up of professionals races almost in complete silence. They only exchange information about the wind, the location of opponents. Let's go that way. Lower the sail. Pull on the rope to your right. Now try to steer the boat. Always look forward. Now try to steer hard. See?
It's quite sensitive.
There's a gust of wind coming up. You see it? That'll make us go way faster.
So is this good weather for sailing?
Yes, this is great weather for sailing. We hate calm weather. Zero wind is the worst. There's a yacht going over there. Let's not hit it. Push on the tiller, hard. Push it. Harder. Steady now. It was a small yacht. It could have crossed our way.
Are there rules as to which way you should turn?
We were going on the port tack, and they were on the starboard tack, so we let them pass first.
Got you. So sailing, Jenny, is considered to be quite, I guess, an elite form of sport. What would you say the culture's like, and what's the community like who sail here?
The sailing community is very friendly and tightly knit. There's a reason why sailing is known as the gentleman's sport. We always support each other. Whenever a sail or a rope snaps on a boat, we will always lend a spare one. We may compete fiercely out on the water, but on the shore, we're friends and we get along very well.
Yeah. Do you have any customs or rituals or superstitions when you're taking part in a race, Zhenya? The famous Kiwi, Peter Black, used to wear red socks because he believed that they would give him luck. I see you're not wearing red socks, you've got black socks today. Is that your ritual?
All sailors have lots of superstitions. I don't think I have any special beliefs. We just give each other high fives now. When I was a kid, I used to have this yellow t-shirt that I would wear to races. I thought it was my lucky one.
And what happened with this?
It just got too old eventually.
What do I need to do now, Zhenya?
Now we'll be setting the big sail, the Genoa. It's very big, so you'll have to pull the ropes really hard.
Okay.
3, 2, 1, go.
Now we have this really big sail out.
That's stunning.
You're going to control it. You need to keep looking forward on the blue side of the sail.
This side, yeah.
The more you let go of this rope, the faster we'll go.
I think we've caught the wind a bit.
Yeah, we caught a nice gust here. See that wind?
No.
Can you see these dark spots on the water? Dark water means there's a gust of wind going over it. The wind is stronger there, so the boat will go faster.
I see it now.
Have you ever heard the saying that sailing races are like chess on water?
I've never heard that phrase before.
We use these wind spots to see where the boat will go faster. So strategic thinking is very important here.
It's a thinking man's game, like chess. Fascinating.